U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson says he has no regrets about his failed campaign for governor of South Dakota. After all, he still has a job to do. You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Dusty Johnson did not make that runoff election for the South Dakota Republican primary. Aberdeen businessman Toby Doden and Governor Larry Roden will face one another on July 28th. Meanwhile, Johnson is still in Washington, but he stopped by the SDPB studios when he was in Sioux Falls to recap his campaign and to look ahead to a new farm bill, to a controversial deal with Iran, and to the impact of AI on everything from our jobs to our health care. Take a listen.
Number one, of course, we only missed the runoff by a couple thousand votes. And so when that happens, you can look at hundreds of decisions made during the campaign. You think, oh, if only that and if only that. But I think from a big picture perspective, we see what happened to me happening across the country. I have nine colleagues in the House who have lost their run for higher office just in the last year. That's highly unusual. D.C. is not very popular. And I think there are very good reasons for that. People like me are losing our races across the country.
Commonalities? Reasons for that?
Well, of the nine, we are generally viewed a little bit more as establishment or Reagan Republicans. Some people might say moderate, although my voting record certainly isn't moderate. But among the Republican primary electorate everywhere, they're real upset at career politicians, and why wouldn't they be? And they're really upset at rhinos or Republicans in name only. And I mean, I had a big lead for most of the race. The attack ads from, you know, Toby and from Larry and from this Defend Us pack, which I still don't know who was behind it, calling me a liberal and a rhino, they cratered our numbers. I mean, we went from a 16-point lead to obviously down by a fair amount, and that happened over the space of a little over 2 weeks.
So did your record with the problem-solving caucus, the mm-hmm. time in Congress when you were really leaning into, I'm going to work across the aisle, this is not about partisan politics, did that come back and hurt you? Were some of the things that you did, the votes that you made, and the actions that you took at that time hurt you in the race for governor?
Yes, although it's interesting, the attacks that seem to have the most power and the most currency weren't connected to like legitimate bipartisan behaviors. So one of the most, as we figured out, one of the attacks that hurt the most was Dusty Johnson has voted with Ilhan Omar to defund ICE. It took me the longest time to figure out what in the world was Roden talking about with that. Near as I can tell, I voted against a Joe Biden era spending package. So since I voted against funding government, I voted against funding ICE. Now, Ilhan Omar voted against that because it wasn't liberal enough for her. I voted against it because it was too liberal for me, right? But it makes it seem like we're on the same side of the issue, when in reality, I voted along with, I think, every other Republican, or certainly almost every other Republican against that. The First Amendment doesn't just protect the truth, of course.
You attacked as well. And
yes.
Some of those attacks stuck to you. And most of the analysts are saying people had an impression that Dusty got a little dirty in this race and didn't protect himself behind some of those unnamed PACs. Although there were those doing work on your behalf, but some of them had your name on it. This is supported by my campaign, and it's a negative flyer about one of your opponents.
Yeah, I think that, yes, of course. I do think policy differences have to be fair game in elections. And if they're not, what are we doing? This is just a popularity contest. We're not going to talk about what in every independent media organization in South Dakota that's fact-checked the claim that it's the largest tax increase in state history has said that's true. South Dakota News Watch, Searchlight, they've said those are accurate statements. And so, yeah, the TV had the one campaign commercial that I had that my campaign ran that did call out that the fact that Larry Roden and John Hansen did work to increase the sales tax. I think that's fair game. Now, I'm not complaining about the ads against me, right? I would note that they maybe had more of an element of name calling and labels than maybe they did a disagreement on legitimate policy substance.
What would you do differently?
Oh, I have no regrets. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I'm sleeping great and I don't have any bitterness. I'm really not a sore loser. I mean, I have I have a passion to do something, not a passion to be something. I mean, I love this state. I'm not going away. I don't have any idea what would be next for me. But whatever I do, I'm going to want to try to have an impact. I want to lead a life of consequence to help others. And that obligation in my heart doesn't get discharged just because the campaign we ran wasn't perfect, or maybe it was. And like nine of my colleagues in the House, it's just kind of a lousy time to be an establishment Republican connected to Washington.
So what will you do next?
I don't have the foggiest clue, in part because I think leaders eat last. I've been spending a fair amount of time trying to make sure that these really talented professionals we have on the campaign land on their feet. Most of them have, but we're not done with that yet. And also because, you know, I've still got a really demanding day job. South Dakotans get one voice in the U.S. House for the remainder of 2026. It's me. And if our team isn't diligent about that, then we're not doing right by our state.
Are you endorsing, supporting, advising any of the remaining candidates, Larry Roden or Toby Doden?
Yeah, of course, I've talked with both Toby and Larry. As I said, I don't want to be a sore loser and really haven't been. So had multiple conversations with each of them and am providing some counsel and assistance to one of the campaigns when they've asked. Nobody's asked me for my endorsement. And of course, in this gubernatorial race, there have been some controversy around people making endorsements when they weren't wanted. And so, of course, I'm not going to endorse anybody unless they ask. I'm trying to maintain a friendly relationship with both gentlemen. Listen, they won, I lost. And I have zero pout in my heart.
One of the things that I heard criticism of was that you lost your way in D.C., that you forgot who you are and that your campaign showed you're trying to please people, answer those questions, get those votes, but Dusty doesn't know who Dusty is anymore. Talk back to that.
I just don't. I guess I would ask, what are the, that's not true, and what are the pieces of evidence of that? And in fact, I think you can see that the campaign, the ads that really impacted this race, the ones that we know from polling really worked, indeed attacked my willingness to try to find common ground in a political environment where I have always known it's not rewarded. It doesn't mean that it's not the right thing to do.
Hmm. Let's talk about what's happening in Washington now. We're getting
to the point, I think for those people who would level that accusation, it's like the burden's really on them. I mean, in an era where the most popular politicians, most successful politicians are pretty good at calling names, when is Dusty called names? When the most successful politicians are often interested in political celebrity, what actions has Dusty taken to engage, to drive his political celebrity? I mean, when you look at the articles about my time in the last couple years in Congress, they're written very much like they were in my first 6 years, which is this is Dusty. He's a policy guy. He's in the room trying to make things happen, and he'll work with anybody to do good. I can find those articles from 2 months ago, and I can find them from 6 years ago.
Hmm. What's the next big thing in Washington other than the 4th of July in America's 250th celebration, some of the policy things that we should be looking forward to?
Well, I'm one of the authors of the Farm Bill, which was a bipartisan work product coming out of committee as well as coming out of off the House floor. We need to try to make sure that our Senate partners feel the urgency so that we can get this passed into law. And there are some things with digital assets that I'm an author of the Clarity Act that's passed out of the House. The Senate's making some progress. I'd like to get that done. I still don't think we're doing enough with affordability in healthcare, particularly around pharmaceuticals. If I had to guess, I would say this Defend Us PAC. We don't know who financed it, but I think there's a decent chance that it's Big Pharma. They've never really been a big fan of mine, and I've never really been a big fan of theirs. And one of the things that I think we need to do a better job of is try to figure out how to bend the arc of prescription drugs in this country toward affordability.
You and I had a conversation about immigration some time back, years ago now, that I still think of because there was like a 6-point plan that you had that I thought was really thinking about how people on both sides of the aisle, if you want to divide people by aisles, would have felt heard from. Then I just heard you say that the time to compromise, you know, voters aren't, that's not doing well if you're running for office, that compromise. What's the future for what you see the immigration policy reform should look like in a world where there's no room for political compromise?
Well, I don't just think it's about immigration. I think it's, I mean, it's healthcare, it's national security, it's, you know, American energy, it's building almost anything in this country. I mean, the same intransigence, the political marketplace rewards fighting, not common ground finding. And I don't really know what to do about that. I think as much as anything, that's been a central preoccupation of my personal time in D.C. And if we're being honest, things don't look – it doesn't look like they're going to get a lot better in the next couple of years than they've been in the last couple. I don't want to say that I don't have any answers. I would say that this is a disease that has infected not just our country but every developed nation, any place that has social media. Social media is an accelerant to the loudest and most toxic voices.
What's the way forward?
Well, in a free society, we're not going to take away people's phones, of course. I mean, I couldn't support that. We're not going to limit the access that adults have to be able to the First Amendment online. I couldn't support that. So I don't really know. An increasing number of thoughtful people that I run with are getting off Facebook, right? They're getting off X. I think that's good for their mental health. I don't know that that does anything for society. It seems like what we need are more common spaces for us to have thoughtful conversations, not fewer spaces where we're all gathered.
So now that we have the overview of some of those big topics, let's go back and dig into a few of them more deeply.
Yeah, right.
What are you hearing from farmers that the pressure is that they want from the Farm Bill that they haven't got from the Farm Bill?
Or the trade war,
the price of, you know, fertilizer, all these things that have been putting pressure on them. What do they need from you and what can be delivered from Washington?
Yes.
Let's start there.
Producers, listen, they are concerned. They would like a farm bill. We got most of the farm bill done during the one big beautiful bill, the reconciliation, stuff like crop insurance, stuff like conservation programs. We took care of that. That being said, particularly rural development, like South Dakota's rural communities, a lot of really key programs we use to make sure they've got the infrastructure they need to survive is in this farm bill. We need to get that done. But honestly, most corn and bean and beef guys and gals are probably a little bit more concerned about the trade environment. You know, we were talking about 80 trade deals in 80 days. That has not come together quite like that. There's been some progress. We're on the cusp of a really important trade deal with India. But admittedly, I'm not a fan of high tariffs as a permanent part of the economic landscape. I've made that clear publicly and with the White House. We need to start moving toward more deals so we can open up market access for great South Dakota producers.
What are you hoping is next with the Iran deal? It's very controversial. It could change by the time you walk out the door here. So, but what are your hopes that we could move forward with that?
We're admittedly not in a great spot. It is not hard to imagine that Iran has more leverage today than they would have had 6 months ago. That's not what we want. And when the president says we can't let Iran have a nuclear weapon, I think lots of Americans, not all Americans, but a lot of Americans nod their heads. I think they understand that extremists with weapons able to destroy the planet is not a good thing. I haven't seen the agreement yet. I mean, I've seen leaked copies that I don't know whether or not they're accurate. But the agreement that has been cut, at least so far, doesn't seem to provide much in the way of a serious impediment to Iran getting a nuclear weapon.
And the strait is open, but the strait was open before. Have we spent some of our capital in the area of threats? You know, we don't have a heavy stick now because we've already used it and it didn't accomplish what we wanted to.
I think that, yes, there are lots of economic ramifications. There are a lot of political ramifications, not just in this country, but in Israel. I mean, I think Netanyahu is just about as unpopular today as he has ever been. And he's been thrown out of office before. So that's really saying something. But the economic impacts and the security impacts to me are obviously much more important than the political impacts.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about health insurance because I just talked to somebody on the phone before you came in who had been laid off because of AI. and has a 2-week window to figure out what they're going to do with health insurance next. And it's very, very expensive right now. There will be more and more people as the AI disruption continues to roll throughout our culture who are disrupted and who are going to face gaps in their health insurance coverage. What can be done from Washington to provide support for those people? At the very least in a transition, but possible long-term disruption.
Yeah, so I'll double back to the health insurance, because obviously for the individual families that's who are affected, that's really important. But when we talk about the AI disruption, we know that those conversations have driven a huge change in Americans' opinions about AI. They now view it far more negatively than they did even just a year ago. That is a big mistake for our country. I mean, the Industrial Revolution destroyed a lot of jobs. We wouldn't go back to pre-Industrial Revolution. The computer revolution destroyed a lot of jobs, but we wouldn't go back before that. Clearly, both of those technological revolutions created more jobs than they destroyed and made life for everyday people, particularly poor Americans and others across the globe, much, 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 much better. The AI will do more to advance healthcare than anything else you and I can possibly imagine. My middle son is type 1 diabetic. The day he was born, his life expectancy, well, we didn't know back then he had diabetes, of course, but he was expected to live 25 fewer years than a person who didn't have type 1 diabetes. We now have people at the FDA talking about a cure for diabetes in the next 5 years. Type 1 diabetes, not type 2, type 1. That is unbelievable. What we're doing with around cancer treatments is profoundly different than it was just 10 years ago, 5 years ago. And AI is going to empower that. So AI will bring disruption, but it will be an incredible accelerant to the human condition.
But if you can't access that care, and if that care is only available for people who have insurance and you can't get it, it doesn't do you much good. So access to healthcare matters.
Access to healthcare absolutely matters. But nobody's taking the other side of that, Lori, right? I mean, that's we're erecting a straw man here. I mean, of course.
Right, but what's your message to the person who can't access that healthcare right now?
Well, of course.
It's not going to be just hang on because, you know, AI is going to make your life better.
But this is not new to AI. People have always lost their jobs, right? And of course, we need to have systems in place, which we do, things like Medicaid, things like COBRA, that are imperfect, but also we have struggled with the affordability of healthcare in this country for a long time, which is part of the reason I want to go back to root causes, particularly related to pharmaceuticals, which is the primary driver now of increasing costs of healthcare and health insurance. We know that if we don't do something dramatically different, which I think will be powered by AI, but if we just do the same old, every single dollar of our federal revenues, tax revenues, will be gobbled up just by our healthcare programs in 20 years. There will not be a single nickel for a battleship, not a single nickel for Mount Rushmore, not a single nickel for a poor kid's school lunch. And so what we know is that if we don't figure out a way to dramatically, through technology, I think, bend these cost curves towards sanity, then no one's going to have access to quality care.
Thank you so much for stopping by.
Absolutely.
That's U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson, and that is our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.